Man, it's good to see y'all and good to be together this morning. As always, it's such a blessing to be a part of Forest Mill, continues to be, and so thankful to be a part of a church body that loves one another the way we do, that serves the way that we have been called to serve, and that worships the way they do, and thankful for the gifts of Chad and Tommy and our elders and who have been leading us this morning, and the guys who are technically making this happen for all of you who are at home or are over in the auditorium this morning. It is a big coordinated effort, I'm here to tell you, and I am amazed every Sunday that we are able to pull it off, and so I'm very, very appreciative of that. It's a complicated thing. Pray that you this morning are being blessed by our time together, and that in turn we will go out and be a blessing to our community. Now, I'm sure that you have heard about the big scare lately with dihydrogen monoxide. It's actually a hoax, and it's been around for a long time, but it received a lot of media attention back in 1997 when there was a 14-year-old student. His name was Nathan Zahner, and he circulated this petition to ban the substance as a part of his high school science fair. And according to Zahner, dihydrogen monoxide may cause severe burns, accelerates the corrosion and rusting of many metals, and has been found in the excised tumors of terminal cancer patients. And despite these risks, he further noted that this nefarious chemical is often used as an industrial solvent and coolant in the production of styrofoam. It was used as a fire retardant. And anybody who remembers high school chemistry has now figured out that dihydrogen monoxide is just the technical name for H2O, water, right? And Nathan Zahner's story is, it's kind of a funny one. In fact, his science fair project received quite a bit of attention. But I think it illustrates a really important truth. And that is that it's possible for us as human beings to develop a lot of misconceptions about something, even something with which we are intimately connected. Like we can get the wrong idea about something we think we know inside out. For us this morning, what we think about God matters. What you think about God matters. Your theology, what you think about God matters. It affects how you treat God. And for us as Christians, it affects how you engage with God, how you worship God. So I, like many of you, I grew up in a Church of Christ. And, boy, glad I got rid of those guys. And, many of us who grew up in Churches of Christ, you may have a similar experience to this, because I can still vividly remember many of the dire warnings that came along with any lesson that had to do with worship. And it was like those bright red and orange and yellow placards you see on chemical tankers that you go down the road. And these warnings were like danger and handle with caution. Does anybody remember that? Just raise, if you remember sermons on worship like that, raise your hand. For those of you at home, it's just me. Everybody else had great experiences, obviously, but I remember those because I want to tell you that my experience of those lessons and their warnings on me, it was, what I read and heard was keep back, stay away. My experience of worship became remote, distant. It was performative. It was, this is the way I thought about worship was just do what you're supposed to do, but don't get too close. Don't get too involved. Don't get too caught up in worship because it is dangerous. And then there were many illustrations of Christians who worshiped in other ways that were supposed to demonstrate the dangers of getting too caught up in worship. And so as a result, I pushed back and sort of detached, and this kind of became me. I had swung from one extreme, kind of all the way to just pushing back and disconnecting. Because again, what we think about God matters. So the question is, what's the remedy to that, right? How do we approach God both with fear and trembling and also engaging ourselves? How do we draw near, like how do we, you and I, draw near to a dangerous God? And for the purposes of our lesson this morning, I think one of the most helpful and revealing stories in this matter comes from the second Samuel chapter 6. And just to give you some context, back in 2 Samuel chapter 5, King David had this long and terrible feud with Saul. This was before he was king. And finally in chapter 5, David becomes king. He wins the feud over Saul, so to speak. And David becomes king of Israel, and he fulfills what God had promised him long ago through the prophet Samuel. And David conquers Jerusalem, and he makes Jerusalem the capital city for the entire nation. And then also in chapter 5, David battles and defeats the Philistines, obviously with God's intervention and God's help, which was an enormous military victory. In chapter 5, everything is going for David. Everything's sort of going his way. All the dominoes are falling. It is all sunshine and rainbows and unicorns. Everything is good for the new king. So it makes sense now that we come here to chapter 6 that David decides to have a celebration, right? Everything goes well. Let's have a big celebration. And central to the celebration that David wants to have is the act of moving the Ark of the Covenant to the new capital in Jerusalem. So David arranges for this enormous procession, 30,000 men with singing and music. 30,000. People walking and singing and playing all sorts of instruments, we're going to find out. Now, you've probably all heard stories about the Ark of the Covenant, either through reading the Old Testament or Bible classes when you're kids, or maybe even through popular movies. It is a kind of a well-known device in literature. But what was its significance? What was the big deal with the Ark of the Covenant? Physically, the ark was just a box that's made out of wood and covered in gold. It was built during the time of Moses, and it was carried around by the Israelites everywhere they went. When they were going through the wilderness, and they had to set up camp every day and then erect a place to worship, and the Ark of the Covenant was sort of the middle of their camp and inside the tabernacle, the tent. And that was a big deal. In other words, the Ark of the Covenant represented the very presence of God among them. It was God among us. It was considered the most holy, most sacred object, not just in their camp, not just in their community, but in all of the earth. This was the meeting place between God and earth. And for that reason, no one, not the priests, not eventually the king, not even an animal was ever allowed to touch the ark. And if they did, they would die. This was kind of a way of showing how holy, how completely distinct and powerful God was, how other God was. So in order to, you had to move it around every day, right? So in order to do that, God commanded that there would be poles inserted. When he described the building of the ark, he had these metal rings built on the side. And in order to move the ark, you would slide a pole on either side through the rings, and it would be carried around and lifted onto the shoulders of the priest. And here are two archaeologists who are reproducing this historically accurately act of moving the Ark of the Covenant. And so David, because of all the great things God has done for him, all the victories from back in chapter 5, David wants to bring this ark, the presence of God himself, into the capital city, into Jerusalem. So he orchestrates this enormous celebration to worship God. And in chapter 6, verse 5, we read this. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with castanets and harps and lyres and timbrels and sistrums and cymbals. And I don't even know what all those instruments are, but you can imagine it was a great cacophony. I mean, like a lot of noise going on. The scene that's set forth in these first five verses represents how often we in the church, especially in America, can view and worship God. That sometimes we in Western Christianity especially view God as the one who makes everything great and solves all our problems. He's the one who wins all of the battles, physical, spiritual, emotional, you name it. God is the battle winner, or we might call him the Almighty Improver. And we worship God as the Almighty Improver. We view worship as a celebration, and music obviously played a central role in theirs. It plays a central role in ours, just as it did for David. But that celebratory approach comes from our tendency to focus on the good things God has done for us, all the blessings in our lives. And by the way, I should say rightly so. God has indeed blessed us richly. And when my life is all full of the chapter 5, sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns, rejoicing is a totally natural response. So in the church, sometimes we can often paint this picture that if you will come to Jesus, if you will be a part of his church, and you will give your life to him, your life will be nothing but full of victories. Everything's going to be great. God's going to help you. God's going to defend you. God's going to promote you and take care of you. And everything is going to be perfect if you'll just come to Jesus, and we'll just celebrate every Sunday how great everything is going. But when we get back to our story here, we see that there is now a problem. It's found in a detail of the story that I don't want you to miss. It's in verse 3. We're told that David moved the ark by placing it on a cart. Now, that's a very small detail, but it's a really important one. Because remember how God had commanded that the ark was only to be transported on the shoulders of the priest by those poles that ran along the side, right? By putting the ark on a cart, David had ignored God's intention, God's commands. He wasn't showing God the reverence he was due. David became so fixated on God's goodness, which God had been good. Again, not dismissing that at all. God had been fantastic. God deserved to be praised. God deserved to be honored and lifted up. But David was so fixated on that he didn't acknowledge God's holiness, God's otherness, his separateness. So in a sense, we could see, you know, David's celebration, his bringing of the ark, was an act too flippant. It was done without consideration for God's holiness, God's power. Anybody else as a kid love fire? I sure did. It fascinated me. I mean, I loved it. It's beautiful. It's powerful. It's amazing. I loved getting to be around a fire. Any fire. Didn't matter what fire. Bonfire, wood-burning stove, campfire, trash fire. Didn't matter to me. Fire's fire. Fire's amazing. And so one time I was over at my grandmother's house, and she had this garden back behind her house, and she was cleaning up, getting ready for the spring planting and clearing out the brush and the sticks and all the stuff that had come down over the winter. And so she had started a little fire, and she was just feeding it with the stuff she was cleaning out of her garden. But that fire was starting to die down because she was getting close to the end, and I couldn't let that happen because this fire had to continue. So while my grandmother worked away diligently, I snuck into the garage to try to find something to keep this fire going because it was really important that we keep the fire going. And there it was, the perfect solution. It was an old 5-gallon red plastic container of gasoline. And everyone knows that gasoline is a great thing to keep fires going. And it was about half full, so I was a little kid. It was still pretty heavy to me. And I remember I lugged this 5-gallon jug back to the garden, and here was the fire, and I was just leaning over the fire with this 5-gallon, like I had propped on my legs, leaning it over towards the fire, when my grandmother saw me. Whew, you thought the fire was going to be explosive. You should have seen my grandmother. She came unglued. Right? She yelled at me, "It is a miracle I did not drop the whole thing into the fire." And by the way, if you have never seen someone pour gasoline onto the fire, just go to YouTube and find World's Stupidest People. I mean, it is a bad, bad, bad combination. And so I was, by the grace of God, able to lean back without ever pipping any of that gas out. But what I often think about is how closely that story was into turning to something far worse. All because of my lack of fear and respect for the power of fire. Similarly, David's instructions for the Ark of the Covenant demonstrate a lack of fear and reverence toward the holiness and otherness of God. And that thinking, that flippancy, that lightness, that disregard would have dire consequences. So we continue reading down. There was the fire. There in verse 6, we read that when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. And the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. And then David was angry, because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me?" So in this story, the cart that is holding the Ark of the Covenant is being pulled by oxen. One of the oxen stumbles on a obviously not modern road. Cart tilts a little bit, maybe. Ark begins to slip off the cart. And so one of David's men, and we get the idea that David really knew who Uzzah was, probably either a priest or a close spiritual advisor, something along those lines. He reaches out, again, probably without even thinking about it, this is going to fall, and he reaches out and he touches the ark to prevent it from falling, and because of this, God strikes him dead. And we read a story like this, and it strikes me as incredibly unfair. Maybe it strikes you as incredibly unfair. Here's a guy who's trying to prevent the Ark of the Covenant from falling to the ground, just puts out a hand to stop it, and God strikes him dead. Why would God kill a man for an innocent mistake? It wasn't like Uzzah was like deliberately just like rubbing his hand on the ark thinking, "Boy, this ark would look really cool in my living room or something." It wasn't like Uzzah was like, "This stupid thing, I wished it didn't even exist," and was trying to push it off the cart. I mean, he just tried to keep it from falling. He wasn't trying to do anything irreverent or disrespectful. Now, I could come up here this morning and I could tell you all sorts of explanations about why God struck down Uzzah. Theological reasons about God's holiness or pragmatic reasons about God wanting to teach his people a lesson. And I could do that, but I'm not going to, because I don't think that's the point of this story. In fact, if you are disturbed by this story, if it bothers you, if it angers you, that God apparently killed someone for unthinkingly touching the ark, you're not alone in that. Because David was angry too. He thought the whole thing was incredibly unfair. He was thinking along the lines, you know, what kind of God would make me a king, would defeat my enemies, place Jerusalem into my hands, do all those good and wonderful things, and then kill one of my friends for an accident? And then soon David's anger turned to fear that was the God he was serving. So much so that David's like, "I don't bring the ark here. Just put it in this guy's house over there." He sends it to Obed-Edom's house, who's nearby, instead of bringing it on into Jerusalem. In contrast with seeing God as the almighty improver, there's a different view now. It's God as unfair and disturbing. I think David's experience in these verses is indicative of the way a lot of people view God. I mean, in our culture broadly, a lot of people view God. I can't tell you, whenever people find out that I'm a preacher and get to know me a little bit better, that's one of the number one conversations I have about the unfairness, often of the idea of predestination. In fact, I've had multiple conversations about that in the last couple of months, about how unfair that was and what the Bible says about predestination and why would God do that, and then also about why God allows all these bad things to be happening in the world. People largely believe that God exists, but they're just not sure that he's on their side. Because God sometimes either does things or allows things or doesn't stop things, however you want to think about it, that we just don't understand. And so sometimes we get angry and afraid. Why does God allow bad things to happen? Why do innocent people who make mistakes die? Why is there such devastation in our world? Why is this one virus continuing to sweep across the world, and now we're our nation, over 400,000 deaths linked to this one virus? Why? And sometimes we have an answer. I mean, we have an answer that these are the exact sequence of events that led us to the place where we are and all that. And we could do the same thing in the story of Uzzah. Technically, we know why Uzzah died. He wasn't supposed to touch the ark. He touched the arks. But sometimes even those like exact right answers still don't bring us the comfort that we're really looking for. It may give us the right answer. It does not give us peace. Our answer doesn't take away the fear, doesn't take away the anger. And because the pain that many have experienced, either on a cultural level or a personal one, it leads many people to just sort of push God to the side. Yes, God is there. I think he's real, but I just can't have anything to do with him. Like David, they cannot understand him. Either they doubt his goodness and they become angry, or they fear his power and they become afraid. But in either case, you got no desire to have God near you. Do not want to worship that God. So we've sort of seen a couple of extremes on views of God. Either it's drawing him so close as to become overly familiar and flippant, or pushing him so far away so as to become detached. But I think there's one other possible way, a third alternative that we see in this story. Down in verse 11, we read that the ark stayed at Obed-Edom's house for like 3 months. And the text goes on to say that the Lord blessed him and his entire household. The guy where the ark, whose guy's house, who is housing the ark in his place, God blessed him. And we don't know what those blessings are. No idea. Maybe they had a good harvest. Maybe all the women had a bunch of kids. Maybe they, who knows? But there was something that happened that everybody was like, wow, God is doing something great over at Obed-Edom's house. I'll bet it's because of that ark. And it was so good that eventually all that news reaches into Jerusalem, where David hears about it. And in verse 12, we read, now King David was told, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God. So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. In other words, David hears about what's happening to Obed-Edom, and he's reminded of why he wanted God to be near him in the first place, why he wanted to be near God in the first place. He's reminded of God's goodness and reminded of God's blessings, and he wants the blessing of God for himself, not just for himself personally, but for the entire kingdom. And so he decides to bring the ark to Jerusalem as planned, and then he goes down himself, and in verse 14 and 15 we read, wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might while he and the entire household of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sounds of trumpets.
And all this sounds like suspiciously like it did back in verse 5, right? It's a big celebration. It's a lot of joy. There's extravagance. You've got people singing and thousands of people and dancing and trumpets. And it's all an homage to God's goodness. But this time something has changed. It's something that's mentioned in the verse we skipped there, verse 13. Verse 13, this is the story of the progression of the Ark of the Covenant. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fatted calf. David went down to be with the Ark himself, and when they took six steps, he killed a bull and a fatted calf. Now, there are a couple of important details to notice. First, it says the Ark was being carried. No longer on a cart. Now it wasn't being brought on these poles on the shoulders of the priest, just as God commanded. And David's learned sort of the lesson of the irreverent casualness that he had earlier. But second, when we hear this about the sacrificing a bull and a calf, this is not like the one-time deal. This is every six steps. From Obed-Edom's house all the way to Jerusalem, every six steps kill a bull and a fatted calf. One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two. I mean, can you imagine that journey and what their robes must have looked like by the time they walked through the city gates? Right? Now, in the Old Testament, animal sacrifice, it was a way of honoring God out of your wealth. Herds of animals were the currency of their day. It represented property, it represented status, and David is giving everything to God, not just his dancing, not just his songs, but he is giving bull and fatted calf after bull and fatted calf. He's given the best of everything he's got, his entire life. So what we see here is that David's attitude has changed, has grown. His view of God has grown. There is celebration, but there is also sacrifice. There is rejoicing, but there's also reverence. It's a worship that praises God's goodness and is humble before God's holiness. Kind of get both sides there. So here's what I want us to sort of see this morning. That worship is about celebration and sacrifice, rejoicing and reverence. It takes both. And in this story, David is still dancing. Like David is still dancing in his linen ephod, and people are still singing, and they're still playing trumpets, and he's still like putting all of himself into drawing near to a God who is good and benevolent and offers blessings. David is still doing that, but he's also considering the other side, that there's a lot about God we don't understand. There's a lot about God that doesn't make sense to us because he is so holy and so other, and that what God does, I don't have all the answers to, and I don't have everything down pat, that this God is still dangerous. And this morning, what we've come here to do, I mean, I've been in churches where people really like get all dressed up, and ladies will wear nice hats, and men will be wearing a bunch of nice suits, and everybody, it's like a picture, right? I mean, everything looks just perfect. But the description of this God is like, we need to come in here with strap-on helmets and life preservers and ballistic vests, and because this God is dangerous. This God to whom we have been singing and praying, he's a dangerous God. He holds your next heartbeat in the palm of his hands. He holds the air in your lungs between his lips. And that is not a God to be dismissed lightly. That is a God to be taken with reverence. And at the same time, every good thing that we have, we owe to his benevolence. We could throw ourselves on the ground and bow before Him and just give all of our energy and all of our singing, we just did that, it would not be enough to acknowledge all God has done for us. If you were to stand up and get on top of your chair and shout for hallelujah for the next hour and just give God everything you had and you put on a linen ephod, I don't know if anybody's got a linen ephod in your car, but if you did that and then you danced before the Lord for the next, you know, few hours all day long, that would be not enough to acknowledge all God has done for you. We've got those two sides of God that we have to take into account when we come before Him. That He is due both all of our rejoicing and all of our reverence and all. That we cannot become too flippant and we cannot become too distant. Because the worship that we are offering up to God is not for God's benefit. God does not need your worship. It's not like God's up there and is like, oh, I don't feel good about myself today. If only somebody would sing a song about how nice I am, then I would feel better. God doesn't need that. God is sufficient in and of Himself. You know who needs worship? You and I, we need worship. We need to acknowledge who we are before who He is. That is the power and might of worship this morning. And we've been talking about some of the spiritual disciplines over the last few weeks. We talked about studying God's word and prayer. And I don't want to undersell the importance of worship, whether you are at home or you're over in the auditorium or whether you're here this morning. Your life needs to be marked by times of worship because that shapes your view of God. Just as much as your view shapes your worship shapes your view. So I encourage you this week to spend time in worship alone, together. Worship the Lord our God. Worship with all you have. And worship Him in His holiness. May God bless you in the study of His word this morning. And this time, Tommy's going to lead us in a song. Let's stand and let's sing.